Welcome again to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, where we speak with C-level executives, scientists, and law and sector experts to provide actionable investment insights and the context with which to understand the burgeoning cannabis industry. I'm your host, Rena Sherbel. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Great to have you listening on this long holiday weekend. We are excited to bring you three episodes this long holiday weekend. One today, one tomorrow, Tuesday, and one on Wednesday. Today, we are talking to Joe Crothers, CEO and founder of Syrus, which trades on NEO and is one of the more well-known SPACs in the cannabis industry. Really happy to have him kick off SPAC Week Part 2. We know, because we talked about it last time, SPAC Week Part 1, the overwhelming number of SPACs coming to the broader markets in many different sectors. Certainly, the cannabis sector has been no different. Billions of investor dollars invested into these SPACs in the past couple of years. This past year has seen it exponentially grow, and Joe Crothers is one of the leaders in the cannabis SPAC space. And he talks to us today about Syrus, what they're looking for in terms of who to partner with, and what they feel like partners are looking for in a suitor, talking about healthy relationships here, people, on President's Day weekend. When it's good for the acquirer and good for the acquiree, we talk about the notion of cannabis in South America, the working theory, and how it may or may not play out. We talk about why SPACs make more sense than traditional IPOs and the benefits there that Joe sees for the market, and why the market has taken such a liking to SPACs and why that likely will continue, and what we have to look forward to in the near future in terms of SPACs in the cannabis marketplace. And we talk about the cannabis market in the US, in Canada, what Joe sees there. And come back for Tuesday's episode with SPAC rock star Chris DeMuth, who has founded a SPAC-focused hedge fund, runs a SPAC-focused Seeking Alpha Marketplace service, and has a ton of worthwhile insights to make about the SPAC market. You don't want to miss it. That's Tuesday. And Wednesday, Michael Orbach returns to the show fresh off Subversive Real Estate. And don't call it a REIT because it's a SPAC. Their deal with leading Israel player Intercure. Don't miss that one either. It's a great catch up also on the parent company. In the meantime, enjoy our conversation with Joe. Hope you are enjoying the long holiday weekend. And if you are outside of the States, hope you're enjoying your Monday. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice of any sort. I am Long Trulieve, Chiron, Isracan Biosciences, the parent company, and Air Strategies. You can subscribe to us on Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Joe, welcome to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Really great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rena. Appreciate it and glad to be here.
I'm interested, and I'm sure listeners are too, like how you got to the cannabis industry, how you created Syrus Acquisition Corp.
Yeah, so you know, I guess got into the industry back in late 2016, early 2017. I'd been at an investment bank at Goldman Sachs for 12 years, and really sort of had felt like, look, cannabis is a place. You know, as I learned more and more about it, you know, back in 2016, you know, this industry really has legs, and I think it's one of the few places that, you know, that you can do good, be on the right side of a movement. I think on the historical side of things, and you know, make money in the meantime. And I think there's a lot. I think you can do a lot of things well in cannabis, and I think that's why, you know, that's why I got excited about it originally, and made that terrifying phone call to my parents saying, I'm after you've paid for all this education and things, I'm going to go into the cannabis industry now and leave my Wall Street world. And I think now it's funny. I've told people this before. You know, 3 years ago, I didn't tell a lot of folks what I did because I was afraid of judgment and those types of things. Well, now I don't tell a lot of people what I do because it's all they're going to want to talk about for the rest of the night. So it's really funny in 3 years how much things have changed. And like you said in the opening, you know, look, last night I think is it, people will make a lot of it, I think, because of of sort of what it could imply, and they immediately think that this means legalization is coming, and it's not that, but it is such an important step, right? And it's a signal, and a lot of things I think that have us headed in a place that you know continues to back up, I think, my decision to get into this industry, and it's been what a great experience. I think I've learned more in the last 3 years than I did in 10 years at Goldman, simply 12 years at Goldman, simply because it's just every day is brand new and there's so many new and interesting things happening here. It's such a fascinating, case study of how business and people and bringing an industry above ground, how all that works together. And it's just been a great ride.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It really combines a lot of things, for people that have just been in the business world. I think it expands people's horizons that are then coming into the cannabis industry. I'm curious, were you looking, like, coming from Goldman Sachs, coming from the financial industry, were you looking for something that maybe had more meaning or did worked on another level aside from kind of just accruing profits?
That's exactly right. It was sort of, look, there just aren't many times, I think, where if you are a quantitative, numbers oriented person, right, and you're in finance, you are always thinking about what's that next opportunity, but rarely do you get the chance to think about what's the next good opportunity where I can do that and do really good things all at the same time. And I feel like cannabis gives us that opportunity. And again, to sort of be on what I think history is going to look back at the right side of a movement and help, sort of usher that in, I think is, that gives so much more meaning to the work that I'm doing than, pushing paper, right? Which is effectively what it was, a glorified version of pushing paper, back on Wall Street. And I think to me, this adds such a different element to that, and makes that much more exciting, engaging, and I think fulfilling over time.
And how did you settle on Cirrus specifically, or that business model? There are a number of ways to get into the cannabis industry. How did you settle on that specific way of getting into it?
Yeah, I actually, when I left Goldman, I started a distribution business in Northern California where we were essentially, and take yourself back to 2016, 2017, things like trim and making a lot of, distillate oils, et cetera, wasn't what it is today. And farms were still just wanting to get rid of trim at that time. So what we were doing, a lot of what we were doing was brokering trim products from farms to some of the big manufacturers in Oakland and San Francisco. And so that's how I got my start. Was the first 9 months in the industry was running product basically back and forth up and down the interstate to make oil and those types of products from. So I got to start in a very specific part of the industry, which for me really let me get sort of insight into how the farmers think and what challenges are they facing. What are the dispensaries dealing with? What are the manufacturers dealing with? What are keeping these folks awake at night? And what I realized is money in the industry, capital to fund their businesses and to grow was a very natural place for me because of where I had come from. So to me, the industry almost told me exactly where to go once I got started. But I felt like I needed to learn it from the ground up, get my hands dirty, so to speak, and leave the whole the financial side and the spreadsheets behind for a little while and really try to figure out how the industry worked from the bottom. And to me, it was. That experience, I think, has set a foundation for me being able to tie the unique aspects of cannabis into traditional business and other industries and doing the analysis on those and being able to merge those two things together. Because to me, that's sort of what cannabis really needs, right? Is some combination of keeping itself, where it's come from, not forgetting that, while at the same time, modernizing itself, right? Being able to be a above ground business. And I think there's a very delicate push and pull that needs to happen there. And for us, I guess when we started Cirrus in 2017, it was basically it was sort of listening to the folks I was working with and what their concerns were. And we really discovered that money and marketing were the two of the biggest points that were causing difficulty for folks. And because I was getting questions from old investment folks at Goldman and old clients and things, you know, that's where, you know, we got together with a group of old friends and we all saw this opportunity, all coming from different sectors and different industries, and thought, look, this is an interesting place to be able to apply some of those experiences and try to sort of bring them into cannabis and see what we can do there. So now we're, you know, 4 years later, we've done, you know, 12 deals on the private side. And then, as you mentioned, with Cirrus Acquisition, we have a SPAC. So we have sort of two pots of money that we invest into cannabis, all solely cannabis focused. That's all we look at. We'll mostly US. We have done some international that we do. We do have a few opportunities there that we've been part of. And then now in March of last year, we took a SPAC public and are now searching for targets to de-SPAC.
So talk to me about that process of the SPAC. You know, there's a crazy amount of attention right now on these SPAC deals, really, you know, across the market, but certainly in the cannabis industry. Talk to me about what your focus is right now and where you're looking to head kind of going forward.
Yeah, so you know, the way the SPAC works, and I think it's so interesting for cannabis, and this is really why we did a SPAC. You know, we've been investing privately, and in cannabis, that's essentially, other than obviously the names traded in Canada or U.S. traded names that are doing business outside of the U.S. For the most part, most of cannabis has been funded privately, right, up until this point. And you've got those few companies, and our thought was, look, there's, you know, there's a gap here, right? There's, you don't have institutional money investing in cannabis. There's a need for capital, a very stark need for capital. And how do we sort of find ways to get those companies that need larger checks? You know, they've grown their business over the last several years and they now need to go to that next level. They need, you know, sort of access to bigger pools of money. It's not, you know, 100,000 here from a friend or a neighbor or whatever. That works great those first few years, and then you sort of outgrow that and you need that next step, and that's where it's been lacking for cannabis, and that's one of the places where I think you know, for the companies that are prepared and equipped to be public, which obviously has an entirely new set of, you know, issues to deal with, right? You, once you're in that public spotlight, you've got a lot of new boxes to check, so to speak, right? If you're operating those businesses. So if you're ready for that, to us, it sort of made a lot of sense to merge those two things, right? And I think the SPAC allows, what's really creative about the SPAC structure, I think works so great for cannabis, is it not only fills that gap, which I think is so important, but it also, the way it's set up, it allows the investor to sort of wade into the deal sort of softly and carefully, which I think a lot of investors, they're intrigued by cannabis, but they're a little spooked. They maybe don't quite understand it, but they want to figure out, okay, how do I sort of start to wade into this? And I think also from the operator standpoint, they're looking at the public markets and going, wow, I don't know, it's a bunch of finance people and I'm not sure. I just want to run my business. I don't want to deal with all this capital market stuff, you know, and et cetera. And I think this SPAC structure allows those two groups to come together and have conversations that aren't adversarial in the same way a public, like a traditional way IPO typically happens, right? Where you as the business owner are sitting there in front of investors saying, I think I'm worth X, and they're beating you down and saying, no, you're worth Y. In a SPAC structure, you've already got the public shareholders, right? And they during this time get to look at what companies you're looking at and say, okay, this is interesting. This is something I'd want to invest in. So they get to sort of slow in. And if they decide they don't want to do that, well, they get to take away a treasury-like return. So they got what I call a free look into a deal, right? They get to decide, I like that and I want to move forward, or no, I'm just going to take my interest and go away. So that's where it allows them that easy step in. And then on the operator side, I think those conversations being more collaborative versus adversarial, you know, you've got these folks that have an interest in staying in your deal. Now you just explain it to them. That's a different conversation than trying to prove exactly who you are from the outset. And I think that conversation just allows both parties to be much more comfortable. And I think comfort sort of leads to better, you know, better investing, better partnerships, you know, a better capital base.
So talk to us about the de-SPACing right now, where you're at in the process.
Yeah, so we began publicly trading in March. So we are now, you know, in our, call it ninth month, and we have roughly, you know, call it 21 to 24 months to, you know, to affect a transaction and then do what you refer to de-SPACing. And where we are in the process is we are speaking to companies, you know, either combinations of companies or single companies that sort of hit the enterprise value that we need to hit. Now, we sized our SPAC a little bit smaller because we wanted to focus directly on cannabis, and given sort of the value of what we thought the target population was, we sized our SPAC at 120 million, meaning that we're looking for businesses somewhere between 350 million in enterprise value up to a couple billion in enterprise value. So we could fall into anywhere in there, and I can get into the intricacies of the SPAC process and how that wide range sort of comes about. But what we're looking for is single state operators, deep single state operators, right, that have a really interesting presence in a good market, or multi-state operators, vertically integrated folks that are in multiple states, and then you know, folks like, you know, brands. There's not a lot of just straight CPG brands. Usually there is a vertically integrated component depending on geographies. So for the most part, it's MSOs and deep SSOs is what we're spending the majority of our time focusing on. We really want to stay close to the plant touching side of the business. We think, look, that's the core of the industry. And it's been very easy because of federal illegality for folks to focus on ancillary products. But at the end of the day, you still got to grow cannabis. You got to sell cannabis, you got to make it into products. And for us, we think that's still the best place to be, if you want to deal with the headaches of all the regulatory schemes and things that are out there, of course.
So a couple follow-up questions. Number one, sure. You know, in terms of institutional capital coming in, it's obviously at the very beginning stages of that happening in the cannabis industry. But
Yeah. Let's
say a couple years down the road, I mean, at the way things go, let's say 6 months down the road or a year, whatever time frame it is that becomes kind of more popular, or let's say, you know, a SAFE Banking Act passes or something that makes it more attractive for institutional capital to come in. Does that at all worry you in terms of them being, you know, another source, a good source of capital? Does that worry you at all in terms of the SPAC deal?
On the SPAC front, no, not as much, because I still think there's, you know, there's still such a compelling reason, you know, if you're prepared and set up to be a public company, there is still a lot of benefits to doing that and making that move. I mean, just today alone, if you're a public company, your valuation most likely just went up by 10 or 15%. So you're sort of riding that general macro wave of, you know, cannabis, you know, cannabis's evolution, right? Which is going to be, I think, a positive thing over time, certainly, right? And it'll have some ups and downs, of course, as we've seen. But over time, I think that's a good place to be. So I think you still, if you're ready for that, I think you want to still be a public business. But you're right, it could help fill the gap, you know, on the folks that aren't quite ready for that step, but they still sort of are in that place where they need a larger check. So I actually think the benefits are going to outweigh the competition side of it. There definitely will be more institutional money coming in. So folks like us will have more competition for deals, but at the same time, the investor base should significantly increase, right? In terms of the folks willing to invest in cannabis, to feel safe investing in cannabis, the funds that can now invest in cannabis. Once you get that descheduling, then I think that's where a lot of that, the investor side, sort of the supply and the demand, both are going to change, but I think the demand will change even more.
And do you, I guess that kind of dovetails into my next question, which is in terms of this, you know, the saturated SPAC market at this point, in terms of everybody's looking for, you know, a good company to buy up everybody, you know, and then those companies are looking for capital. In terms of everybody finding each other, do you think that just feeds off of itself in terms of there are so many kind of companies that need help or that could be, you know, undervalued and that you guys could bring to a different level? Do you feel like there's so many different players that could use help that it feeds off of each other? Or how do you see that going in terms of just the numbers of it?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think there is some pure momentum, sort of a snowball effect that you're alluding to, and I think that's absolutely right. I think it causes, and look, we noticed this right after the November elections. It had sort of been, you know, a couple months leading into those elections, it had felt like a lot of conversations were just sort of had kind of turned into a little bit of paralysis, right? It was, well, let's just wait and see what happens. And we're dealing with this COVID thing. Cannabis had a very rough patch going into COVID. I think COVID, you know, we'll look back on this period and say this was a net positive for cannabis as an industry. So many positive things will have come from it as a result. But it didn't make it you feel any better during those first 6 or 8 months of COVID, right? It was, oh man, we've had a really rough patch getting in, and now the whole world is scared, and where does that leave us? And those benefits of being, you know, deemed, you know, an essential business, and obviously the regulatory environment probably being sort of having its hand slightly forced, you know, in terms of budgetary issues that have come from COVID or have piled on since COVID. I think all those things help push cannabis forward, and we'll look back on it positively. But again, during it, you don't feel that way. So I think the path we took in had a lot of folks very spooked. But I think what happened in November there's some reinvigoration there, and you've heard of several deals. And this is getting to the point of your question. I think you've seen several deals announced. You know, Verano, the Caliva parent company deal with Subversive, and you've seen a couple international cannabis things get done recently, like Clever Leaves in South America. So I think you're right. It's forcing folks to ask the question, wow, okay, other people are looking at this as a solution. Do I need to do this to compete well? Is this my chance to be really aggressive and opportunistic here? And I think that's what you're seeing as much as anything. Which I think sort of at the end of the day makes the SPACs better, right? I think that's one thing that we've done that is paying benefits to us is we really thought, how are we going to compare to other capital provider solutions that are out there? In other words, other SPACs that are out there, how will we be the most appealing SPAC to that company or to those targets? Not just thinking who's the most appealing target to us. How are we appealing? And I think, you know, that was really a focus of ours. We tried to size ourselves in a way where, you know, the economics were more favorable for the target. We brought in partners like Red Light, MGMT, 72 and Sunny, so that we could help on the marketing, and the advertising side for the eventual target. So I think there's a lot of things there we're trying to do to make ourselves look like an attractive partner. And I think that's a healthy thing over time, right? Different SPACs have to be thinking, all right, how do we compare to each other? And it forces sort of everyone to level up a little bit. And I think that's a good thing. But you're exactly right. It is definitely heating up in terms of folks looking at, wow, what else is going on out there? This is an option for me. I really need to dive into it. And we're definitely seeing a lot more very active conversations in the last two months now, I guess.
And you mentioned before that the institutional capital coming in, it doesn't worry you from a SPAC perspective. Does it worry you from another perspective?
Well, it's more, I think you said it exactly, right? It's competition for a deal, right? It's how many different folks are able to write, call it a $3, $5, $10, $20 million check. If there's only three or four of us out there that can do that, then obviously you sort of have the pick of the litter, right? But again, sort of the same way it forces SPACs to level up, I think it forces all the private, you know, all the private funds to do the same thing, to be better at what they do so that they are a more attractive investor into, you know, the most exciting deals that they want to get into. So I think it's a healthy thing. But yeah, it at the end of the day, I think it technically, you know, makes my job harder on the private side when you get more and more funds and folks that are willing to put money into the industry, that'll get more challenging, but it'll be good for the industry.
Yeah. So looking at the states, you know, we talked about these bullish developments, more states going online, the developments out of Georgia definitely seem bullish. What are your thoughts, on the picture of the U.S.? And, you know, you mentioned these kind of skyrocketing share prices. Do you think they go back down? There's a period of volatility. Do you think it takes like full legalization to work out those prices? Where do you think it goes in the near term?
Yeah, I think the difference, I think, in the share prices you're seeing today versus what you saw a couple years ago, is that now if you really compare those side by side, you'd look at the numbers you were seeing a couple years ago and say, wow, what were people thinking? You know, it was all a hope and a dream of we can make a ton of money, but we're all trading off of, you know, 3 years out revenue expectations, right? And that's very little more than a finger in the air, right? And sort of guessing wind speed. So I think now, though, when you actually dig into it, these companies have proven out a lot of that, right? So now you actually have a foundation with which you can justify some of these valuations. Before, it was what Greenspan would have called irrational exuberance in the 90s, right? And I think that's sort of what you saw, you know, in 17, 18. And then obviously that came crashing down in 19 and late 19 and 20. And now you're seeing that come back. And I think the main critical difference is that now it's much more warranted. There's now businesses that have proven there's a path to being worth these values, to actually justifying what these values are. And I think that's a major difference. That gives a confidence. It can't be understated that over the last couple of years, the attitude towards cannabis in general is, I think it's just very different. I think it's changed so quickly. I think the legitimization of it, I think has really changed the way a lot of folks look at it. And I think, so to me, all of it now is sitting on a much stronger base. So yes, you will see fluctuations, right? Those margins will expand and then they'll compress and they'll expand again. And those things will continue to happen. But I think now we are sitting on a real base where the story's been proven, and it's not just, you know, the electric car market where we're talking, you know, today, right? We're talking about 2023, 24 numbers. I think folks really want to see something sooner than that, ideally, right? And I think that's where we are now in cannabis. We now know this can work. And we know, and there's a playbook for it. I think that gives folks a lot more confidence. So I think you're going to see, I think you'll see cannabis continue to do well. I think people want to, they believe in the growth story. They know that's there. And now it's really just, it's getting some of these little regulatory issues out of the way. Banking, you know, getting some of those, you know, what I would sort of call basic business enabling tools to come through to where businesses can really operate cleanly and you know, do things the right way there. So I think there's plenty of opportunities for those levers to get pulled, which investors will look at as opportunities for, you know, for increasing share prices, et cetera. And I think they'll use those as opportunities to invest.
So what do you think? I mean, I know that this is a crystal ball question and I know they're somewhat unfair, but just given your given your experience in the field, and what do you see? Do you think that this is like a harbinger or of the MORE Act passing? Do you think the Safe Banking Act passes? Do you think none of those pass and it just keeps being a state by state thing until it's an inevitability? Where do you see it going?
Yeah, look, I think it's going to get really hard, I feel like, over the next few months for, you know, for the federal government to continue sort of kicking the can on simple business enablement tools like, you know, like banking access. Those types of things, to me, I do feel like those will change in the near term, which I think that starts to make a lot of the changes we've discussed, right? That starts to make a lot of that more possible. 280E is another really big one. I don't know that goes away this year, and that's not necessarily part of safe banking, but those things have to get addressed. Otherwise, you're essentially handicapping, you know, the legal market. Simply, you're making the black market far more competitive when you make that pricing difference, and that it's almost a cost to be the legal business versus the illegal business. It's not almost; it absolutely is. It's very expensive to be the legal player, so they've got to sort of level that playing field if they really want the industry, I think, to fully be able to take off. And I think you'll start to see some of those things this year. I don't necessarily think, you know, I do think Kamala and the new administration will work towards getting those things done, some of those pieces done. I don't know that you see rescheduling right away. I think we're still a little ways from that. And I do think it will be effectively a state-run industry for a while, if not essentially forever, sort of the way alcohol is, where really there are state-level mandates, and really the federal government essentially just says, not that we're legalizing it, but we're just going to kind of stay out of your way. I think that's sort of, you know, the overall setup that we're looking at, and I think it probably makes the most sense. You know, the federal government to be regulating cannabis when they don't really regulate alcohol, it, to me, it makes a lot more sense for each state to be able to decide that. Now, that may make it messy, a little messier over time as well, but I think that's probably how this plays out.
And moving north for a second, what are your thoughts on the Canadian picture? Do you have optimism there?
In terms of, so Canada, if we're thinking about Canada in terms of the companies that are based there, like, you know, the Tilray's, Aurora's, Canopy's, et cetera. You know, obviously it's been a round trip a little bit for them, right? There was a lot of focus on large cultivation facilities in Canada. A lot of those have been abandoned and they're looking to do cultivation in other places. They're sort of stuck out of the US market, which I think is tough on them. You know, for US operators, someone like us looking at plant touching in the US, being listed on a Canadian exchange, we think actually is a great advantage today, because it allows us, once you get the, you know, safe banking and other things happen, you know, fast forward another year or two, and you've got the possibility of being listed on a US exchange as a plant touching business in the US, our move to that is going to be easier than trying to go public from that point. So I think just moving exchanges there, it gives us a nice advantage there and gives us obviously that public market access now. So the Canadian markets, I think, are still a very important piece of cannabis. I think the Canadian producers, you know, look, they still are some of the best capitalized. They've been around the longest. They have some of the biggest footprints, but I think they have some structural challenges, you know, because they aren't allowed into the US yet, in a lot of cases. And there's, you know, and I think there's been some difficulty. You always take a lot of scratches and bruises when you're the trailblazer, right? And I think you're seeing a lot of that because Canada was first. That's where a lot of those folks came from. And so I think you're gonna see a lot of bruises there, continue to see some bruises there. But look, it sort of had to start somewhere, right? And I think Canada being the first to really try to get organized, you know, these businesses up and running, I think they just made some mistakes on trying to grow it there. You know, now moving that to South America and other places, I think that's sort of caused some slowness and you know, some pain for them. But, you know, I think there'll still be several Canadian winners out of this for sure. And their presences in places like Europe will continue to sort of drive them forward.
So you guys aren't looking at any of the smaller Canadian players?
We haven't looked much at Canadian, at any of the Canadian based companies, no. A little bit, but that's not our main focus. Our main focus is on the US.
And just, you mentioned also South America, and I wanted to touch base with you on that also. I know you have some experience in the South American markets. I'm wondering where you see that going. There's some hesitation. Some people are bullish. I myself feel like it's about to happen and there's companies that are going to really be able to succeed there. What are your thoughts there in terms of that happening?
Yeah, there's sort of two schools of thought, it seems. And I think this is what you're alluding to. There's the two schools of thought. One seems to be that, look, like any other commodity, cannabis, you know, the cheaper you can produce high quality product, you know, that makes sense as a source, right? If you can produce high quality product for a much cheaper price, which is what we're doing in Uruguay, you know, we're in a tax-free environment, labor costs are lower. There's a lot of benefits, obviously, to cultivating there. The biggest one, frankly, being tying it right back to the Canadian conversation we just had, is that you're cultivating in an environment where cannabis naturally, you know, likes to grow, right? So you're not fighting nature there every day, which I think is really important. You're essentially the same latitudinal line as a Carmel, California. So almost the perfect environment. And you're sort of you're the opposite side of the world. So your timing of harvest is sort of offset, which I think is beneficial. So the two real schools of thought, right, are where is Europe going to get its supply from? Is Europe going to supply itself? Or is South America possibly, because of that, you know, sort of Econ 101 theory of, you know, high quality product at a cheap price will find a market? If you believe that there will be global trade of cannabis, then I think you can't argue with the idea that producing high quality product at the lowest price is a winner. The other school of thought is that folks in Europe are going to close their borders to importing cannabis and say that all the cannabis we sell here in, say, Germany is going to be grown in Germany. If that's the case, then the South Americans are really only left to supply themselves, right? Because I don't think any of us are expecting importation into the States on any major scale. You know, our operation out of Uruguay has a DEA import permit, so we import small amounts into the US, but all for research studies, et cetera. It's not a major sales channel. So the real sales channels are Australia, Europe, someday Asia, Africa, et cetera. But really Europe is the focus now. So who's going to supply Europe is where that really comes down. And cost effectively, it's hard to argue against South America. But if you believe that folks are going to get very protectionist and protect their borders, then South America becomes a bigger stretch in terms of where are their real sales outlets over the next several years. I think everybody would agree with you that 5-6 years down the line, it's almost a no-brainer, right? If you've got high quality product at a low price, it's going to find the market. Question really is these next several years, how does sort of Europe supply itself, and how quickly does that market grow to eat up that supply from South America?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely an interesting question of where things go. I think, we had an interview last week, and I'm based in Tel Aviv, about Israel and Israel's kind of how they're navigating the import-export dilemma. It's certainly like a really interesting part of the cannabis supply chain in terms of, everybody talks about building this new business, but literally we're like building a new global business, and we're still kind of working out how things will play. It's hard to see everything, but it's certainly interesting to think about how all those things end up. I'm curious.
Yeah, and we are selling product into Israel too. And you're exactly right. It's these pipes are sort of being connected and opened up as we speak, right? We didn't think we could even sell into this market. Well, maybe we found a different angle and a way to get in there that keeps with their regulations. And though it is fits and starts, it feels like every day in terms of learning what those new channels might be, which is exciting, but it's also painful. But you're right, it's a very big factor in what we do every day.
Yeah, it makes things interesting, makes things more difficult. Those things tend to go hand in hand. I'm curious, like coming from the background that you come from and being in the cannabis industry, how much do you feel like the legacy market, how much do you feel like the people that were a part of the legacy market, do you feel like there's pushback from kind of that community of the industry, or do you think for the most part people are excited at the growth that kind of people coming in with a more financial acumen, what that brings to the industry?
Yeah, and I think there's a couple ways to sort of think about this. My approach to cannabis the whole time has been, I need to align myself with somebody who knows where the bodies are buried, who understands the plant, has been in this industry for a while. Because to me, the right way to do things in this industry is to take an outside perspective that can say, okay, here's how it's done in other industries. Here's how we can modernize and make this make sense in a legal context today. But at the same time, you can't just do that, from coming from outside ice cold. Cannabis is unique. Yes, you can compare it to other commodities, and sure, you got to pay to store it. It spoils over time. It devalues. It costs to store it. There's all these things that are similar to something as simple as corn, right? But at the same time, it's extremely different than that. And there's a lot of institutional knowledge. The folks that really know what consumers want, how the plant reacts to things, how to get the best products, being creative on the product creation side. Those things are almost all of those folks still are, pre-legality industry players. And I think finding ways to align, newcomers to the industry and the folks that know it the best, that to me is the right combination. And that's actually was the foundation of Cirrus. you know, one of my partners is a 20-year industry veteran, right, who's been doing this for a very long time, understands the plant very well. We go into cultivation facilities and he can really get into the nitty gritty of exactly how you're doing this, why this makes sense, how does this lead to your yields being different? A lot of those factors that somebody like me coming from the outside can't do. I can quantify it after a lot of that data is understood. And so to me, it's a combination, really. It's almost both sides need to embrace each other. And I think it leads to a much more powerful combination. But I do think there is some, directly answering your question, I do think there is some frustration from the folks that have been in the industry for a long time, that the guys like me come in from the outside and end up, running a large company here, and they wonder, how does that doesn't make sense. That doesn't seem right. And in a lot of ways, I agree. For me, even though you might see me at the top, there's all the people right next to me that are have been here for a long time that are really the only reason I'm able to do that. So I sort of look at it as the strongest combination is some experience there, and then trying to modernize that experience and put it into a legal framework in an industry that's trying to sort of check all the boxes, right, that other legal industries check, and that I think that takes both groups working together. So I really think that's one thing that we look for actually in our investments is what is your cannabis expertise and what's your outside expertise, and are you valuing both of those things?
Yeah, I think well put. I think as we see the industry mature, it certainly seems that a combination is the thing to get a company kind of to the top of the leaderboard. I think it's hard to do, as you said, it's hard to do if you only have one or the other. I think just kind of, theoretically, it's nice too, and it's a way to incorporate people that have been in the business a long time. But certainly there's further to go, yeah. And certainly we see that happening now. So we see that playing out. I'm curious where you see kind of the industry in the next like year, 2 years, 3 years. Where are you? You said that you're more focused on the plant touching companies, but is there something that you're excited about? Are you excited about the beverages? Are you excited about something from the extraction CBD world? What has your interest these days?
I call it the siloing of outcomes. So thinking about the different cannabinoids that are out there, right? CBN, CBG, that we're really, everybody talks about THC and CBD. There are a lot of the same way we compound pharmaceuticals, come up with combinations of pharmaceuticals that get you a very specific direct outcome. You want to sleep better. You want to eat less, whatever it may be. I think what we're going to see over time is these cannabinoids being compounded and being understood in a way to where cannabis could be your new friend in the bedroom. It could be your new friend in the kitchen. It could be your new friend in the car. It could be your new friend at the dinner table. I think that to me, it's what alcohol never had and never will have, right? In terms of a tailwind that says, there's a recreational component to this, but there's also a medical component to this that it's almost impossible to even figure out what the limit of that is, right? I mean, I've heard everything from 80% of pharmaceutical products could be replaced by various cannabinoids, that we've got to get the industry to a place where it can deliver on something like that. And the science has to sort of lead the way there. But that's what has me the most excited is that I can't honestly tell you what the most exciting thing is going to be in 2 years. I can tell you 15 things that might be, but that to me is what makes it cool, right? That we could go a lot of directions and be talking about a lot of really exciting things. And I think people ask all the time, like, have I already missed cannabis? I already missed it. And I still think we're in the first inning. At the end of the day, I think we're still in the first inning of this.
Yeah, it's so funny. People are so anxious about missing it. Just get in. Just get in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't worry about missing it. I'm curious, like, how far do you go on an idea, or does it depend kind of like what company you're looking at? Like, how far do you pursue, what's going to be in a few years, like these new cannabinoids, or does it just depend on the company that you're looking at and working with?
Yeah, I mean, look, we make investments, you know, up and down the supply chain. And the part I didn't mention, sort of the second step of that, is what we call the consumerification of cannabis, right? All those these products and these new, you know, things that we can help people with. We have to deliver on that, right? The science has to tell us what to do, and then once we have that, well, then we actually have to manufacture products that live up to that standard. Those types of things still have to be done. So I think there's a ton of you know, basic sort of blocking and tackling type things that have to be done to get there. But I think there's a very exciting piece on the consumer side coming as consumers are getting more educated, demanding better products. I think you're going to see a lot of movement there. But we look for some component, right? Of, and this is you know, back to the challenge and the opportunity in cannabis is that you want to look at how are folks planning for 2 and 3 years out, but at the same time, none of us really know what 2 and 3 years out looks like at the end of the day, right? So I think you have to have an eye towards that, but you also have to make sure you're doing smart things today. So it's like any other industry. At the end of the day, you're looking for smart operators that don't think they know everything. They're very confident and know what they're doing, but they also realize, wow, there's a lot that could change. So I need to be nimble and prepared, you know, for that. So it's pretty typical, I think, in terms of the attributes you look for in an investment. But there obviously are some new angles. You need, back to your point or the point earlier about, you know, needing real cannabis experience. I think you need real finance experience in a larger cannabis company that's dealt with cannabis financing before, because cannabis financing is different than financing other things because so many avenues are cut off for you. So you've got to get creative. You've got to, you know, got to have that network built to weave your way in through the specific nuances of funding a cannabis business, which is a lot more challenging than funding a typical business.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Speaking of the commercialization of the industry, do you think, like, speaking to the point of, you know, in the next few years, kind of developing those new cannabinoids is going to develop and really increase the efficacy and the quality and you know, how we're understanding how that treats consumers and patients. Do you think once that is kind of more figured out, if not totally figured out, do you think that brings in the CPG companies and it expands really the commercialization and makes it much more widespread?
Yes. I think a little bit, you know, like CBD, for instance, I feel like, you know, it caught on as its potential benefits. And I think so many of the potential benefits, right, are accurate. However, the products don't deliver on those. You can say CBD implies that, oh, it's going to help with your anxiety, help with this, that, the other. Well, if the product is manufactured in a way, right, that is actually delivering it into your system, you're dosing it properly, if all those things are happening, I think CBD can be what we think it can. The problem has been that I feel like CBD is going to, you know, is a little bit getting tarnished because the products aren't living up to what the promise is. So yeah, I think as consumers are getting more educated and learning these things and this is, you know, sort of becoming more known, I think you're going to have to see those companies are going to have to level up. And I think when you see that is when you're going to see some of the big names come in, right? And that's where you're sort of get some consumer trust and feel safe around, okay, well, this brand wouldn't do this, but what didn't make sense. That could be right or could be wrong in a lot of cases, of course. But I think once you see that movement start, that's where you do see some of the big names come in from outside and some of those, you know, I think they'll feel safer entering the market. And I do think that will help the consumer experience in terms of their trust of the industry, but that doesn't necessarily help the, you know, the folks that have been in the industry for a very long period of time. Right. So I think that's where the older school industry players, we've got to do a good job of talking about how, you know, we're manufacturing product, why you can trust these brands, why you can do those things. I think that's going to become very important.
Yeah, you feel like those companies, I mean, the companies that are already in the, because, you know, obviously people are worried about, or some people are worried about the alcohol companies, the tobacco, the CPG companies coming in. But certainly so many people also feel like and I think what you're saying is this also, that the companies that are already in existence really have a leg up because they figured out all of those variables, and more than that, have established themselves as a name to consumers, and that is just inherently a leg up. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think those companies will have a couple, they'll have a couple options, right? Go it alone and compete with those folks and rely on all the things you just mentioned. Or, you know, do they get swallowed up by those folks and take that expertise into those larger places, which again, there's good and bad. And there'll be some that choose both of those routes. So we'll have both, right? And you'll have your boutique folks that are old school industry folks, and then you'll have, you know, the Marlboro, if you will, right, that comes in and produces large scale cannabis, you know, more on a conveyor belt. I think you'll have sort of both of those. But yeah, I think the folks that are in it today definitely will have an advantage and will have options, because I think it's way too undervalued that cannabis is unique. I think folks come in thinking this is just like anything else. If I've packaged a CPG good before, I can do this. That's not necessarily the case. There's a lot going on here. This industry's been in place for thousands of years when you really do the math. And there's been a lot that's been learned over that time. And you don't just walk in today and automatically have that knowledge. So to me, I do think there's an advantage for folks that are already in the industry. The question will be, you know, as we go forward, the brands that come in, you know, how do consumers react to that? And do they value the folks that have, you know, that really do know the plant and have been here for a while? And I think there will be a large component of that. So I think there's a safe place for those folks.
All right, Joe, this has been really interesting. Do you have anything else you want to leave listeners with before we go?
Yeah, look, I think all the things that we talked about today, if your listeners aren't investing in cannabis or aren't looking at it, they should be. There's a lot of opportunity there. And I suspect most of the audience is already investing in cannabis, but look, I think the next several months are going to be really exciting. You know, for folks like us that have money to deploy and for investors that have money on the sidelines, you know, look, I think it's a very good time to really take a deep dive here, and start paying attention, because I think there's a lot that's going to happen here in the next 12 to 24 months in cannabis. And a lot of it will come sentiment wise. And then a lot of it, I think you'll actually see the pen hit the paper, and actual changes being made over the next 12 to 24 months. So I think it's a great time to be listening to podcasts like this and to be thinking about investing in cannabis. So kudos to everybody who's listening.
Couldn't agree more. For everybody wondering if it's too late, it's not too late. There's still, I think, some great investments to be had. For the reason Joe's expressed on the show, I really appreciate you sharing your expertise and your time. It's really been a pleasure, and thank you for the conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Subscribe or follow us on Seeking Alpha, Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or Stitcher. And we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other investors find our show. If you have feedback or questions, we'd love to hear from you at RENA+CANPOD@SeekingAlpha.com. That's RENA+CANPOD@SeekingAlpha.com. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.